Before we begin our Torah study, let's pray together. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kidshenu b'mitzvotav, v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who sanctifies us with his commands and commands us to engross ourselves in the words of Torah. Amen. As we open up the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, as we know it in English, we're going to be reading about the life of Moses and the life of the children of Israel, the condition that they're in Egypt, and how God brings the children of Israel out, and how they move forward in this journey. And so I want to focus on a theme that's inspired by all this that's simply called finding our way. We need to find our way. And I want to use our occasion of studying the book of Exodus, studying Shemot, as an opportunity to think about some of the issues that we in the Messianic movement are facing and some of the things that will help us find our way so that we don't get lost and we don't go off in the wrong way and we don't lose sight of who we are and what we're called to be as individuals and as a community. So we'll be exploring that theme over the next few weeks. And in the process, we'll talk about some challenging ideas, may ruffle a few feathers. There may be a sacred cow or two that gets slaughtered, who knows? But I think the intent is to provoke us to think and to understand and to pay attention to what God has called us to focus our attention on and not to give our attention to lesser things or insufficient things. Now, in order to start, you can turn to Shemot, to Exodus chapter 1, if you would like. And in verse 8, it says, "There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Say that with me, did not know Joseph. So this king, this Pharaoh, forgot how God had brought the Jewish people to the land of Egypt, forgot how God had used Joseph, a child of Israel, in order to actually save the Egyptian people. Without Joseph, the people of Egypt would have starved to death. Without Joseph, the people of Egypt would have been decimated and destroyed. Without Joseph, even the kingdom, the government of Pharaoh, would have been reduced to nothing. But there arose a Pharaoh, there arose a king who did not know, paid no attention, did not think about the Joseph or about how God had used the Jewish people in a way to bless Egypt. And what he did do was he paid attention to the fact that the Jewish people were doing well. And he looked at their prosperity. You can read about it in the next few verses now or at home on your own. But he looked at them and he saw that they were increasing and he was upset. And he even used the language of insects. They're like bugs. They're swarming everywhere. And if we don't deal with them, they're going to destroy us. And so he aligned himself with a wrong understanding of the Jewish people. He did not understand his own place in history or his purpose. He did not understand how God had already shown mercy to Egypt and would continue to show mercy. He misread everything. He looked at facts, but the wrong set of facts, and he interpreted it in the wrong way. And because of that, he set out to murder the young boys of the Jewish people who were being born in the land. He wanted them killed. He didn't want them born. Yet one was born who was a beautiful child. His name was Moses, Moshe in Hebrew. And I want to just give you a little short summary of the life of Moses. Very short. It's this. Moses was born to a Jewish family in Egypt, but he was raised as an Egyptian in the house of Pharaoh, because as you know, the daughter of Pharaoh saw him in that basket floating on the river, and took him and raised him as her own son. So Moses grew up as an Egyptian in the house of Pharaoh. He spent 40 years away from his Jewish family and with his Egyptian family. I don't know what he called Pharaoh's daughter, but I wouldn't be surprised if he called her mom or something like that. He learned Egyptian. He spoke Egyptian. He conducted himself in an Egyptian way, and yet he was a Jew. He actually was born into a Jewish family, and he was raised as an Egyptian. Now, you probably know the story. How many of you know about the time he saw that taskmaster beating up the Israelite and he intervened? That led to his exodus. Moses had to leave Egypt. And Moses spent the next period living in Midian far away. He married into the family of a man named Yitro. In English, we would call his name Jethro. And Jethro was a priest who had some limited understanding of God, but he actually served God according to that limited understanding. But while Moses was there serving as a shepherd in Midian, he had an encounter with God. Or we could say God had an encounter with him. And there was the burning bush, right? Where God revealed himself, and he revealed himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not the God of Egypt. He revealed himself distinctively and definitively as the God of the Jewish people, and then he sent Moses, who's now in Midian. His kids are Midianite kids, if you will. They're raised in Midian. His wife is from that area. His father-in-law is a Midianite priest. So he's now in Midian, but he gets sent back to Egypt. The Lord brings him back to Egypt in order to lead his own people, the Jewish people, out of Egypt, out of slavery, and into a life of service of the God of Israel. Isn't that a mixed up history? Now, some of you have a mixed up history too, and you can relate to this. It's like, man, I come from all over the place. And you might say, well, I'm like a little of this and a little of that. I'm not even sure what I am or who I am. Well, through this crazy history, Moses had to realize who he was. He had to make some conclusions about who were his people. And he had to come to a serious conclusion: who was his God? It was the God of Israel who called him. It was the God of Israel who sent him back to Egypt. It was the God of Israel who said, I want to save my people, so you go back and get them. I think Moses could have said, listen, I used to be a Jew, but really, I was raised as an Egyptian. But now I'm a Midianite. You got the wrong man. But the Lord had the right man, didn't he? He knew who he had called, and he knew that he could use that crazy mixed up history for good. So through this, Moses chooses his Jewish identity. He chooses his Jewish people, and he chooses the God of Israel. And I believe this reworked his past. And in a sense, it gave him a whole new perspective on the present life he was living. And it also gave clarity to the future that God had in mind for him. When you choose the God of Israel, when you choose to be joined with the Jewish people, when you choose to do what is pleasing in the sight of God, and to find your identity, first of all, in God and how he made you, no matter how crazy and mixed up it may be. To find God's perspective on you, it will help you make other choices that will cause your life to make sense. Now, I was reading about Moses, and I was thinking, you know, that the scripture also says that that Moses was from the tribe of Levi. He was a Levite before we knew what Levites were all about, in a sense. And I thought, gosh, I'm also from the tribe of Levi. On both sides. So, you know, some of the Levites, I like to say, they were part of the worship team. They could play musical instruments. They could sing really well. I was from the sub-tribe of Schlepper. The Levites who didn't necessarily sing, but we could carry stuff. And so for me, you know, carrying things was good. My grandparents, all four of them, were not born in the United States. Only one was born in the United States. The others were born in Russia or Ukraine, depending on what day it was Ukraine. Yeah, it could be Austria one day, Hungary the next day, Germany another day. There's an old joke, a Jewish grandmother, way back when, you know, during the times of great wars, and her grandson comes in and says, there's been another war. And she says, so what does it mean? And he says, well, we don't live in Austria anymore, Austria-Hungary anymore. We live in Ukraine. And she says, oh, praise Hashem. I hated those terrible winters we were having. So my grandparents, my mother's parents, came to the United States and settled here, but they moved to Israel and became citizens of Israel. And Sandy and I thought we were going to move to Israel. We became citizens of Israel. And just when we thought we were going to move, the Lord showed us, don't move, I've got other places to take you. Other places for you to go. And he called us to the former Soviet Union, and then he brought us back here. You know, we've been all over the place, but we don't live in Israel, though we are citizens. And then I was thinking about my dad and two of my sisters. They were all presidents of conservative Jewish synagogues. My dad was president of the Jewish Federation in our town, too. And so we grew up, like, very involved in the Jewish life, Jewish community, and in the synagogue. We grew up as Jews. There wasn't anything hidden about our Jewishness. We went to a school. I remember there was a tradition at that school to have a Christmas pageant. But my parents got us exempted from that because we're Jews. And they made arrangements for us to stay out of the rehearsals and to sit in our classroom. I sat in my classroom all by myself for hours sometimes. And it was amusing because if the rehearsals were really tedious, the other students would come back in and say to me, "You are so lucky you're Jewish." But there was nothing hidden. So for me, my story is not discovering my Jewishness. My story is different. What disrupted my life was not that I discovered my Jewishness. What disrupted my life was I discovered the Jewish Messiah. What redefined my Jewishness was Yeshua. And when I realized he was Messiah, not an I, it changed my Jewish life. And so now I know who I am. I'm a Messianic Jew. I'm not some other kind of Jew. I'm a Jew who follows Messiah Yeshua. And I don't want to be another type of Jew. An Orthodox rabbi and I were having lunch together, and we were brought together by a Gentile, non-Jew, who had some experience in rabbinic synagogues and also in Messianic synagogues, and he thought we ought to meet each other. And so the rabbi says, I can understand this guy, you know, thinking Jesus is the Messiah, but how can you as a Jew? And I looked at him, I said, it's even worse. Because I not only think he's Messiah, I know he's Adonai. You should have seen the look on his face. So I'm not trying to be another Jew. I'm not trying to pass as another Jew. I grew up as a Jew. I grew up as a Jew in a conservative Jewish synagogue, in a conservative Jewish family. And so I know who I am, but I grew from that experience, and what redefined me was Yeshua. Now, Yeshua didn't make me Jewish. I already was Jewish. Yeshua did not pull me out of my Jewishness. He affirmed my Jewishness, and I began to see that in his Jewishness, I could find my Jewishness. Now, I want to share why I think this is important. This has to do with finding our way. Yeshua said something in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 6, verse 40. He said, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. Now, this helps me understand something so foundational. Luke chapter 6, verse 40. We will become like the ones who teach us. And so the ones who we look at as our authoritative rabbi, if we're Jewish, they will have an impact on who we are and what we become. So who's that rabbi who defines who I am and what part of the Jewish world I want to identify with? It's Yeshua, not another rabbi. Now, Rabbi Yuri grew up, lived in Nikolaev, Ukraine. He can tell you about his experience there. The rabbi of the last rabbi of the Chabad Lubavitch was born in Rabbi Yuri's town in Nikolaev. And then he moved with many in his community to America, and he became the Rebbe of Chabad Lubavitch, a very outward-reaching Hasidic movement. But Schneerson's followers began to proclaim that he was Messiah. And not only that, but I was reading and watching some of the translated videos of Rabbi Schneerson, and I noticed that he has this teaching. It's really an interesting teaching. It goes like this, that there are many people who become like tzaddik, saints, righteous ones, and they draw close to God, but there's a certain kind of tzaddik who actually becomes part of God. And his being actually becomes God's being. Now, what he meant was perfectly clear. He meant he was such a person who was no longer just a man, not even just a rabbi or the Rebbe of this great movement. What he meant is that his being had so merged with God's being that when you saw him, you saw God. Do you understand how dangerous a teaching that is? Yeshua taught that. And Schneerson teaches it. For a reason, Rabbi Schneerson wants to take the place. I mean, he has passed away. But it was his intention to have Jewish people look at him to see God. Yeshua was God coming down. So that when we looked at Yeshua, we did see God. But there's a difference, and a profound difference, when a man says, I've become part of God. And when God says, I'm here. So it's important to understand this. You might think, oh, Chabad Lubavitch is so terrific, it's so great, it's so wonderful. But you have to understand who they say is Messiah. And their theory of atonement. And their understanding of commandments, and their understanding of what are the authoritative texts that we should pay attention to. Rabbi Schneerson says it's very clear that every chassid should study Kabbalah, every male at least, of a certain age. and master these texts, and that there is no Hasidism without Kabbalah. Now, my understanding is very different. Kabbalah is a dangerous text in many ways. And it's filled with magic. It's filled with mixtures of things. And it can be extremely dangerous. And it has an alternative theory about creation, about the nature of evil, and about atonement. And offers solutions for atonement without the sacrifice of Yeshua. So it's important. You should, whenever you're thinking about what kind of Jew you want to be, if you want to be a Messianic Jew, and you say, well, I'm just, you know, I like this group or I like that group, be careful, because you got to know what you're talking about. You have to know what you're getting into. So be careful about what you learn from those who you don't want to become like. That's a corollary to what Yeshua is saying. Yeshua is saying, when a student, when a disciple is fully formed, he will be like his teacher. And so he's saying to his disciples, you'll be more like me, Yeshua, in time. So that's why I'm training you. And that's why it's very important for us to understand, who do we want to become like. Now, if you want to become a Noahide, then study under the Noahide movement. If you want to become a Chassid who learns Kabbalah and who considers that the Talmud is authoritative, and who thinks that there is an oral law that was hidden and is now equal to the written law, then I would say, don't be a Messianic Jew, be a Hasidic Jew. And if you pick and choose, you may end, you know, like, well, I'm going to take a little bit of this and a little bit of that. People may not even know who you are. You may not even know who you are. I'll get to that in a little bit. So if you want to be a disciple of Yeshua, be very careful about what you learn from those who reject Yeshua. Sometimes people in the Messianic movement say, well, I want more Jewishness. And so they go into a synagogue where Yeshua is not recognized as Messiah, where his words are not authoritative, and where there's another view of what life is like. And then they become like that, and they're wondering, like, how did that happen? You know, I didn't intend to be like this. I can tell you how it happened. You came under the influence of those who taught you. It's a principle Yeshua was teaching. The model that you choose, the teacher, the congregation, the community of faith, will impact who you become. Be very careful. Now, I have to say this in a new way at this point in history for two reasons. One, we're living in the internet era, which means sources of any kind are readily available. Number two, we're living in the era of social media, where anybody can put something that becomes accessible to everybody who's like them. And, you know, frankly, I'm alarmed when people in our synagogue who want to be messianic start posting Kabbalistic source material. And they might say, well, I liked what the guy said. That's not my point. If it were a Rastafarian, would you post it? Just ask yourself that question. If it was from an occult practitioner, a wizard, a warlock, a Wiccan, a witch, but they said something good, maybe they even said something just like Yeshua had said, would you post that? Like, wow, I saw this great thing from, you know, the black witchcraft movement. And they said something a lot like, love your neighbors yourself. And so I'm liking it. You know what I would say? You are foolish to such a person. The proverb says the foolish person is a naive person. And they approach evil and they pay the penalty. The wise person sees evil and flees away. So in this modern era, in this era of internet and social media, it is so easy to drink from poisoned sources and not even know you're doing it. That's why I'm warning you. I'm cautioning you. Because it's not theoretical. It's real and in our midst and in the messianic movement, and we need to know how to understand it and what to do about it. So the sources you use will have an impact. The traditions and customs you follow, the people you fellowship closely with, will have an impact on you. And if you hang out with the people who are doing the same thing you're doing, if you're dabbling in something, oh, I've got such a good story about this. If you're dabbling in something together with others, you'll start thinking it's normal. Now, I had a friend when I was a new believer who had an interesting background. When he and his wife became believers, they were like back to the woods people living out in, you know, some wilderness, mountainous area. And you know what they really like to do? They like to get high, smoke pot, get high, and take naked saunas together. They became believers, and that didn't change. And so sometimes they'd get high and try to lead people to the Lord. So when they became believers, not all of their fellowship changed. And it seemed normal to them because everyone they were with was like this. And there'd been this move of God where all these pot-smoking hippies living in the woods and the mountains taking naked saunas together, they're all you know, smoking and they're sharing the gospel, and it seemed normal. Now, right now, does that seem normal to you? No, and after a while, it didn't seem normal to them. It took a while, but even today, I don't mean literally today, but in recent days, I'll see believers who are posting all sorts of let's get high stuff, you know, recreational marijuana and so forth. And I think, okay, is that your Rastafarian history? You know, when you were singing reggae and you were getting high and saying, oh, yeah, and thinking Haile Selassie was God. You know, clean it up. Get rid of it. Don't keep going in that direction. And don't introduce other people to it. And don't think that others aren't on to what you're doing. That's part of why I want to tell you this. I'm familiar with all this stuff. I don't mean firsthand. I mean, I know when someone is posting, for instance, all this stuff about Rabbi Nachman. I know Rabbi Nachman's interesting, but he has led his followers away from Yeshua, not towards Yeshua. He doesn't help anybody come to Yeshua. He's been dead too for a while, but he's still influential. So I'm starting to see how important it is to equip you. Because if you're not equipped, you know what will happen? You'll look around, you may see someone in the congregation who is dressing a certain way or acting a certain way or posting certain things on Facebook or doing stuff like that, and you'll think it's normal. And you think, maybe, wow, it's even more Jewish than I am. They're even more Jewish than the rabbi. Well, I tell you, I'm plenty Jewish. By that I mean I don't have to prove my Jewishness. I sort of feel like Paul, you know, who said, I know what tribe I'm from. I know where I come from. I know my education. I know my citizenship and so forth. So I'm not a newbie to the Jewish world or to the Messianic world. But I want to use tonight just as a starting point, just to raise your awareness, because we're going to keep developing this over the next few weeks. We're going to look at scriptures and we're going to compare scriptures. We're going to see that not every Jewish tradition is a good tradition. Some are not. We're going to see that the Torah is actually the written Torah. There's not an oral Torah that the Torah speaks of. We're going to see as well that there are certain customs that deny Torah or communicate something that takes people away from Torah. So just to end with a couple of details about Jewish dress, if you will, two Jewish things. When I was living in Budapest, Sandy and I went to one of the modern Orthodox synagogues to celebrate Yom Kippur. And when we were there, the president of the synagogue came up to me and he asked me my Hebrew name, and I told him David ben Beryl Halevi. And so he said, would you like to have, you know, the Levite Aliyah for being called up to Torah? And I said, sure, okay. And I understood that in Budapest, if you agree to that, you got to pay money later, as is the case in all synagogues for the high holidays, except Messianic synagogues, just about all synagogues. So I agreed, and then he came back to me, and he asked me a few questions, like, what brings you to Budapest? So I told him some things, and he said, well, I knew you weren't from Budapest. And I said, how did you know? And he said, because of your tallit. You see, I had a tallit that had burgundy stripes. And I looked around, and there were only black and blue stripes in that synagogue, just like the synagogue I grew up in. You know, all the guys wore the same kind of tallit, and it wasn't the color I had on that day. And so he knew I was not from those parts. And then he asked me a few more questions, and I said, I'm leading a Messianic Jewish congregation, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but it could upset people. You know, is this going to bother anybody? I don't have to do it. You know, even though I'm a Levite and I have the right to assert that I could do it. He said, no, that'll be fine. And I said, you understand I'm a Messianic Jew? He said, mm-hmm. I said, do you know what that means? He said, no. So I explained it to him. It only took two sentences. And he said, oh. I said, so think carefully. I don't want to do anything to offend anybody. And he said, they don't know who you are. It'll be fine. And so I did it. But you see, because I was wearing a certain color, I stood out. He knew I wasn't from there. Now, in Israel, the kind of kippah you wear tells what religious movement you're a part of and generally what political movement you're a part of. And so as an example, I've got some data here. The ultra-Orthodox, 58% wear a large black kippah, even if they wear a hat over it. The Dati, who are like Orthodox, 17% wear that large black kippah. And Masorti, what we would call conservative or traditional, 25% wear the large black kippah. Now, if you wear a small black kippah, it means generally you are not Hasidic or ultra-Orthodox. Only a few wear that. But 47% of the Dati, of the modern Orthodox and other Orthodox, wear that. So you're walking into a synagogue and people can look at the kippah you're wearing and know who you are theologically to a large degree. Not only that, they can know who you are politically, what political parties you support and what policies you support. Now, if you wear a black crocheted kippah, there is a 59% chance you're conservative. But only 14% of the ultra-Orthodox would wear such a kippah. In fact, some of the rabbis of the ultra-Orthodox in Israel said, any Jew who wears a crocheted yarmulke is not a Jew. Not to be trusted. Not to have fellowship with them. Not because of the kippah, but because of what it signifies. Now, crochet with pattern or color, like I've got on. Not even 1% of the ultra-Orthodox will wear one of these babies. And so even the ultra-Orthodox are saying about the other Orthodox, they're not Jews. So if I'm in Israel, I have something like this on in any shape or form, any of those kippot that I like to wear, every ultra-Orthodox would know I'm not one of them, no matter what else I'm doing. No matter what else I say. But the color, the shape, the style, all of that indicates whether you think Arabs should be expelled or not, whether you think it's possible to have a two-state solution, whether you think Zionism is of the devil or of the Lord, believe it or not. Now, in America, it doesn't mean any of those things. Not in this part of America. In Brooklyn, it does. So I'm telling you that so that you understand that even the way you dress can have an impact. It can send a message that may be incongruent, incoherent, or wrong. Once I saw a picture published in a Jewish magazine about a messianic synagogue at worship. And one picture had people lifting their hands like this. And that was fairly benign. Another one had a picture with, you know, like 100 people there, like this. And they were worshiping with their head up. And I thought, oh my goodness. You know, the rest of the Jewish world is looking and thinking Messianic Jews are saying Sig Heil or something. Because Jewish people aren't going to gather together and do this. You understand that? And if you lift the Torah up here and, you know, it's like, oh. There's an incongruency. You understand what I'm saying? You may not even know. I'll compare it to something else that's easy to understand. You go to a Jags game, and you sit on the Jags side. Or you go to a Gators game, and you sit on the Gators side. But you're wearing the other team's jersey. You're going to catch it, right? Because they understand. You got that jersey on, you're for them, not for us. And we're the team, we're the fans, we are here to root for you. Now, you do that in Europe or in South America, you get beat up. There's nothing polite about it. Oh, you're on the wrong side, buddy. We are going to teach you a lesson. Now, it's not hard to understand this when you're talking about other stuff, but when you're talking about Jewish things, you have to know what does it mean when you're doing something? What does it signify? What are the hidden meanings? And so, you know, I love our Jewishness in our congregation. I love so many things that we do, but some of the stuff that some people do is like, you know, way over here or way over there. And it's important to know so that you're not caught up in trying to mimic somebody who's doing something you shouldn't mimic. If it became really popular when the Torah came up that everybody goes like this, I'd say, stop! Stop! We're not going to do that salute. We're not going to do that. You understand why? Okay. So, having said that, you know, we are a diverse group, aren't we? And if you come tomorrow, you'll see even more diversity. But it's important to know what the boundaries are so that we can move forward with coherence and with wisdom and with understanding and not get things wrong that could defeat us and confuse us. So I can tell you this is a Messianic Jewish synagogue. We're not trying to be something else. We're not trying to be a church. We're not trying to be a Jews for Jesus group. We're not trying to be a Hebrew roots group. We're not trying to be some kind of nouveau messianic Hasidic, which can't even exist according to my understanding of Messiah and authoritative texts and the actual prohibition against using any kind of magical sources and occult things. We're not allowed to be that mix. If someone says, well, I'm Hasidic, but I don't go for the magic stuff, I'd say it's part of it. So you can't be one without the other. You may think you can, but you don't understand what you're doing. So this is like an introduction. Is this okay to introduce these things so we can think about them and we can compare what does Yeshua say and what are we doing and how do our traditions, how do our behaviors, how do our understandings line up with Yeshua's? For instance, Yeshua's custom was to come to Shabbat, to go to synagogue on Saturday for the reading of the Torah. It's a good custom. So in order to follow that custom, you've got to have a Torah. You got to have a service. You got to have an opportunity to read from the Torah as well. We do. It's a good custom. It can be very useful for us. You see how that one's easy to analyze, where some others, you say, whoa, where did that one come from? You know, we'll go on and on in the weeks to come. I want to equip you. I want to encourage you. Rabbi Yuri and I are doing this together. Rebbetzin Sandy and Rebbetzin Ina, I think, will also have pieces of this. And in some ways, I can tell you, I wish we'd done this earlier. And it may help us if we say, oh, we should have done it earlier. But we got to do it now. So let's close and just thank the Lord that in Messiah, Yeshua, we can find what we're looking for in the scriptures. We can be anchored, and we won't be seduced by anything that pulls us away from the authority of Yeshua and the authority of his word. Lord, I thank you that you're a rock. You're not being tossed to and fro, and we shouldn't either. And we are going to join ourselves to you. We're going to learn and study. We're going to learn your word so that we can be faithful, so that we, like Moses, can have a strong Jewish identity as a congregation, and so that we, like Yeshua and the disciples, could have a strong messianic identity too. Let these come together and be united to the glory of the Father and to the glory of Messiah. Amen. Let's close with Aaron's blessing. If you're standing up and you're by yourself, I want to encourage you to just move so you're with somebody. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmarecha. Ya'er Adonai p'naveilecha v'yichnecha yisa Adonai p'naveilecha v'yasem lecha shalom. The Lord bless you. The Lord keep watch over you and protect you. The Lord cause the light of his face to shine upon you. The Lord be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his face to you and give you his peace. In the name of Yeshua, the Prince of Peace. Amen. Shabbat shalom.